Welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm your host, John Sloop, along with co-hosts Rita Dunaway and Dean Welty, and we are so excited to bring to you today a very special guest, Rafael Cruz, pastor, speaker, itinerant evangelist, and director of a ministry called Grace for America. And incidentally, Rafael's son, Ted, is a U.S. senator from the great state of Texas who just happens to be running for the office of President of the United States. What a proud father you must be.
I watched
Ted give his powerful speech at Liberty University last month, and I was moved by his commitment to uphold the Constitution and conservative principles. I know that he learned a lot of that from you. So I want you to begin our program by telling us how the Lord brought you from Cuba to the United States as a young man, and what were your first impressions of America?
Well, you know, John, we need to start with my growing up in Cuba. I grew up under a very oppressive military dictatorship. As a result of that, the revolution started in the high schools and the universities. So I found myself as a teenager involved in a revolution. As a result of that, I was captured, was in prison, was tortured. But by the grace of God, I was able to leave Cuba. I left on a student visa, came to the University of Texas, couldn't speak a word of English, worked full-time, went to school full-time. And that was late 1957. In 1959, when Castro took over, I went back to Cuba, and I got the shock of my life. Oh. Because that same man that before had been talking about hope and change was now talking about how the rich were evil, about how they oppressed the poor, and about the need to redistribute the wealth.
Wow.
Sounds familiar.
Yes, they began confiscating private property. They began attacking freedom of the press, shutting down newspapers, television stations, radio stations, began attacking religion. To give you an idea, soldiers would come into a kindergarten class and would tell the kids, all right, kids, close your eyes and pray to God for candy. And then they would say, where's the candy? No candy. All right, close your eyes again and pray to Fidel for candy. And while the kids had their eyes closed, they would very quietly place candy on all the desks. You see, as we see all this religious persecution in America today, we need to realize that that is not the objective. That is only the means. You see, socialism requires that government become your God. And in order for government to become your God, you must destroy the concept of God. Well, anyway, I left Cuba disappointed, disillusioned, but so glad to be in the home of the free and the land of the brave. You know, I am so proud to be an American. This is the greatest country on the face of the earth. And I was so proud to be in a country that has such a wonderful heritage. You know, even though I did not know the Lord, he knew me.
Yes.
And he had different plans for me. So I was so excited to be in America, a country where I read so many Horatio Alger stories about people that started with nothing and achieved their dreams. And I learned that this was a country where with hard work and perseverance, anyone could achieve their dreams. So I worked very hard. I graduated from college. Within 6 years, I owned my own business in oil and gas exploration. But I didn't know Christ, actually lived a fast life, very much involved in alcohol, and moved to Canada to start an oil exploration company there. And because of my fast, ungodly life, late 1974, I walked out on my wife and my child and went to Texas. And it was in Houston, Texas, that a man that had sold me a computer in Canada invited me to a Bible study. I had nothing better to do, so I went to this Bible study. And I don't even know what the Bible study was about. But you know what impressed me was the prayer time. They all shared prayer requests. They all had problems. But they had a peace I couldn't understand. Especially there was a woman that talked about how her son beat her to get money for drugs. And yet, how could she have that peace that I didn't have at all? It was that peace that showed me that they had something I did not have. I remember the lady of the house gave me a little booklet called The Four Spiritual Laws and asked me to read it. Well, I read it and I said, that's too easy. She didn't know how to answer. She asked me to come back and visit with her pastor. Well, I got to realize I was a scientist. I spent 4 hours just arguing with this pastor. 11 o'clock at night, I asked that pastor, well, tell me, how about that man up in the mountains of Tibet who's never heard about Jesus? This pastor very wisely did not go chasing that rabbit.
Right, right.
He said to me, well, I don't really know about that man up in the mountains of Tibet, but you heard about Jesus. What's your excuse?
That's great. Well, Mr. Cruz, you obviously have a very unique perspective on America. So I want to ask you, what are some of the changes you have seen take place in America since the time you first arrived here?
Well, you know, when I first arrived, I thought America was such a wonderful country. I mean, I remember at those time in the late 50s, early 60s, a handshake was a contract. Yeah. Honor and integrity were things that people cherish. And then in the late 70s, I was shocked when I saw a government here begin to institute policies that reminded me of that bearded dictator in Cuba. And as a result of the Carter administration, I became involved in an organization called the Religious Roundtable. And this organization, I was on the state board in Texas, together with another organization called Moral Majority, Jerry Falwell's organization, we mobilized millions of Christians to help elect whom I consider the greatest president that America has had in the last 150 years, Ronald Reagan. So it's very interesting, you know, you were talking about my son, John, earlier. When Ted was 9 years old, during that year of 1980, our conversation around the dinner table centered on politics as to why we had to get rid of this leftist, progressive Jimmy Carter and replace him with a constitutional conservative like Ronald Reagan. So when Ted was 9 years old, for a whole year, he got a dose of conservative politics from a Christian worldview.
Wow. Well, thank you for that.
Well, Raphael, you told me last night something else, because I asked you, as a father to a son, tell me, how did you imbue those values in Ted as a youngster? There were two things you mentioned, the Bible and the Constitution.
Well, you know, when Ted was 4 years old is when I came to Christ. Yes. And as I had told you, I had left my wife. Yes. And my son. So I went back to Canada after I came to Christ and asked my wife to forgive me, asked her for us to come back together. She actually was very skeptical. But for the sake of Ted, she agreed. We sold our company in Canada, moved to Houston. And I began reading to Ted Bible stories. I bought him a children's Bible, and I would read him Bible studies, and he would say, one more, one more, one more. And so he grew up listening to those Bible stories, and when he was 8 years old, he committed his life to Christ. And, you know, it was so wonderful. But then when he was entering high school, and you know, the Bible says that our steps are ordered by the Lord. Yes. When he was entering high school, through a client of mine, we introduced Ted to a man by the name of Roland Story, who was the president of an organization called the Free Enterprise Institute. Mm-hmm. So he had Ted reading all the great political philosophers of the framers, like Adam Smith and John Locke and von Mises and Hayek and Bastiat and Montesquieu, reading also the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, Milton Friedman. And then this organization creates a group of 5 kids. They call them the Constitutional Corroborators. They hired a memory expert and taught those 5 kids to memorize the U.S. Constitution. And for the next 4 years, they would go into lunch meetings like a Rotary Club. They would place 5 easels in the front of the room, And while people were having lunch, these five kids would write the Constitution by memory on those easels and then give a half-hour patriotic speech on free market economics and the Constitution.
That's incredible.
During the next 4 years, they gave approximately 80 speeches on free market economics and the Constitution. So before Ted left high school, he was passionate about the Constitution, about the Declaration, about free markets, about limited government, about the rule of law. And that passion became like fire in his bones. And you know the reason I know that my son Ted will not compromise his principles in Washington is that fire is as alive today as it was 30 years ago.
Raphael, against that background, and that is so impressive, but against that background where your son was instilled with these Judeo-Christian biblical values and constitutional principles, against that background, what do you see as some of the greatest challenges in America today?
Well, today, unfortunately, you know, we have had two problems in America. One is that secular humanism has really become the religion of America. We have seen since 1962 and 1963 was a paradigm shift in America when the Supreme Court made two abominable decisions. In 62, they removed prayer from school, and in 63, they removed the Bible from school. From there on, we've seen really secular humanism being an indoctrination process in the schools, all the way from primary schools through the universities. And so secular humanism has really diluted even the church today.
Absolutely.
And as a result of that, our foundations are being destroyed, the biblical foundations upon which this country was built. And then today we have an administration that totally disregards the rule of law, disregards the Constitution, disregards separation of powers. And we are seeing a totally lawless form of government in our country. And as a result, we have seen the consequences of that.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned biblical foundation. What can we do today to restore the Judeo-Christian values and the constitutional principles on which America was founded?
Well, you know, Rita, we need to realize that to whom much is given, much is required. You know, America has a heritage that is so unique. No other country in the world was founded on the word of God like America was. Men and women that came here to have the freedom to worship Almighty God. This is a very unique country that God has used to, number one, evangelize the world. Over 95% of all the evangelists across the world have come from America and the financing of those evangelists. And at the same time, we have exported liberty throughout the world. So we have a tremendous heritage in this country, you know. I am a student of the framers. I love to talk about those men that were on their knees. I believe that the reason the Declaration and the Constitution have lasted over two centuries is because they were forged on the knees of the framers. These were men of God seeking revelation from God, and revelation is what they got.
And even the couple of deists that are often lifted up, Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, though they may not have been evangelical Christians, they acknowledged nature's God, and they acknowledged this sort of Christian worldview.
You know, John, this thing about calling Jefferson and Franklin deists is a lie.
Really?
They were not deists at all. As a matter of fact, there are things that people do not understand. For example, when the Capitol building was constructed in Washington, D.C., before even Congress began meeting there, church services began to be performed in the rotunda of the Capitol with as many as 2,000 people. Yeah. They began in the third year of Jefferson's vice presidency. Jefferson rode his horse every Sunday to those services while he was vice president, and the 8 years that he was president. That doesn't sound like a deist to me.
That's right.
Well, Raphael, you also mentioned a prayer that Franklin prayed when they were in trouble in Philadelphia.
Oh, this is so enlightening. You know, when the Constitutional Convention was going on, it had been going on for about 4 weeks, and it was falling apart because all these delegates were at each other's necks. They were ready to go home. And it was this so-called deist,
right.
Benjamin Franklin.
The oldest man in the room.
Yeah, that addresses the president of the convention, George Washington. And he says, "Sir, how is it that we have not once called upon the Father of Lights to illuminate our understanding? Or have we forgotten when we started this struggle against Great Britain, how we met in these very chambers for prayer every day? Sir, those prayers were graciously answered. Or do we believe that we no longer need his assistance?" He continues, "Sir, I have lived a long life, but the longer I live, the more assured I am of this truth, that God governs the affairs of men." That's not the statement of a deist, but he continues. He continues, "If a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can be built without his aid?" He said then, "As the scriptures tell us, unless the Lord build the house, we labor in vain that build it. If we build this upon any other foundation, we will fare no better than the builders of Babel." And he concluded by saying, "I beseech you therefore, but from now on henceforth, before we proceed with our deliberations, we meet for prayer in these chambers every morning, seeking his wisdom and direction." You know, they left. They left that convention and went to the church of Brother Witherspoon, one of the signers of the Declaration.
A Presbyterian pastor.
Absolutely. And they spent 3 days in prayer and fasting. They came back to the convention in a totally different spirit. And several weeks later, they gave us the greatest document that has ever been built outside of the Bible, the Constitution of the United States of America.
Amazing. And I want to elect a president who talks like that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, this is fascinating, Raphael, and we could listen to you for a long time. But you travel the country preaching, and so you're in a lot of churches and you know a lot of pastors. Share with us your perspective on the health or lack of health of the American church today. And what's it going to take for us to have another new great awakening, as in the days of Wesley and George Whitefield, that had such an impact not only on the hearts of people, but on our politics?
Yes, John. Well, you know, unfortunately, you know, I talked a minute ago about how secular humanism has infiltrated this country. But unfortunately, it has also infiltrated the church.
Oh, yes.
And we have many churches in America preaching what I call the social gospel. They're trying to look more like the world with the excuse of attracting the world. The problem is when the world comes, they don't find anything different.
Yeah. That's right.
Because they talk and act like just like the world, and the church has lost its impact. I believe that a great deal of the responsibility falls upon the pastors.
Yes.
The Bible tells us that if the pastor does not lead the flock, the sheep are scattered like sheep without a shepherd.
And the wolves can come in.
That's right. And that's what's happening in America today. Because of political correctness, too many pastors are hiding behind their pulpits, scared to death of being politically correct. Well, it is about time they become biblically correct instead of politically
and
correct.
Prophetic.
That's right. And they are afraid of offending people, afraid of losing people and consequently losing income. And, you know, meanwhile, we are seeing an unprecedented attack on religion all across America.
What is your take on what happened in Indiana and Governor Pence, who has been a strong defender of the Constitution and evangelical faith, sort of bowing to that pressure? What do you think that implies for the country?
Initially, I, as well as my son, were very encouraged when this bill was coming up in Indiana on marriage restoration. And as a matter of fact, my son even wrote an op-ed praising what was happening in Indiana. And then this movement of political correctness began to put pressure upon Indiana, upon Governor Pence. And actually what they did was even worse than if there had been no bill at all, because they added something about prohibiting discrimination against homosexuals and so on and so forth, which in essence opens the door for now they're coming and demanding homosexual marriage at a church. It actually opens a can of worms. And I was extremely disappointed in Governor Pence that he caved in to external pressures. And unfortunately, Arkansas followed the same pattern, and unless Christians stand strongly on biblical principles, we are going to lose the culture.
Well, Raphael, just to follow up on that, you know, the Supreme Court is meeting right now to try to determine, someone put it like this, the Supreme Court is meeting to decide whether the Supreme Being was right. What's your analysis of what's happening? How do you think the court will rule, and what are the consequences?
Well, you know, John, I am more encouraged than many Christian leaders. You know, the consensus among many Christian leaders has been that the court is going to rule in favor of homosexual marriage. However, I have been reading the comments of some of the justices. For example, Justice Kennedy, who is the swing vote, Justice Kennedy said, the one word that keeps coming to my mind is the word millennia. Marriage between a man and a woman has been something that we have had for millennia. Why are we thinking about changing this now?
Right.
This encourages me. Yeah. But not only that, even Justice Breyer,
yes,
a liberal justice, made a similar comment. We have had this definition of marriage between a man and a woman for thousands of years. Why are we even thinking about that? So I am encouraged if those comments would indicate that they would vote for traditional marriage, we could even have a 6-3 decision in our favor. But it is beyond that. It is really appalling that Justices Kagan and Ginsburg have not recused themselves when they have both performed homosexual marriages. There have been 300,000 complaints requesting or demanding that both of these justices recuse themselves, and they refuse to do so. This really does not show any moral integrity at all. But you know, God is greater, and God can actually change the minds of these justices. I'm actually expecting a positive result.
Well, we will join you in praying for that.
Yes.
Raphael, if it turns out to be otherwise, that you get a negative result, what would be the impact on America?
Well, the impact would be disastrous. Because I'll tell you, Dean, if indeed the Supreme Court rules in redefining marriage and in creating a new civil rights, the next step, mark my words, the next step is going to be the government coming to a church and demanding that a church ordain a homosexual pastor, that they hire a homosexual pastor, that they perform homosexual weddings. And this is going to put churches, is going to put pastors at a crossroads. They are going to have to decide whether they are going to obey God or they are going to have to dilute their biblical principles in order to accommodate the law of the land.
Yeah. Well, the mayor of Houston, where you, I think, used to live, was already trying to censor pastors in their sermons.
Well, let me give you a little background on that. You know, the city council in Houston passed a law requiring that a man could walk into any bathroom depending upon how he felt that day. And a woman also. You could, depending upon how you felt that day, you could walk into any bathroom. But not only that. Let's say a man walked into a woman's bathroom and your daughter was in that bathroom. And she objected. That man could sue her for violating his civil rights. And anyway, you got to realize we have a homosexual mayor
yes.
in Houston. Well, anyway, as a result of this, five pastors decided to try to collect signatures for a referendum to put it on the November ballot. They needed 22,000 signatures. They collected in excess of 50,000 signatures. Well, then she came up with a rule. Well, if one name on the sheet is invalid, we have to throw the whole sheet. Well, that didn't do it. So she came up with another rule. Well, if the person collecting the ballots is not registered to vote, those names are invalid. That didn't do it. The city manager certified that they had enough signatures, but these distractions got it beyond the November election to where it couldn't be on the ballot. So then these five pastors sued the city to try to get a special election to get it on a referendum. In response to that, the mayor of Houston sued those five pastors and demanded all the sermons of these five pastors and all emails or correspondence that referred to her, to the city council, or anything to do with homosexual marriage. And all five of these pastors said, we will not comply. Well, let me tell you something. It's very interesting. The day after that, my son Ted called his pastor, the pastor of First Baptist Church in Houston, where he's a member. And he said, Pastor, I guess you saw what happened yesterday. And the pastor said, yes, Ted, I'm very concerned. And so my son said, well, Pastor, I want to ask you, I would like to have a pastor's rally tomorrow at 11 o'clock, and I want to have permission to do it at our sanctuary. And the pastor begins to laugh over the phone. And Ted says, why are you laughing? And the pastor says, well, Ted, let me tell you something. About a month ago, I was so concerned as to what was happening in Houston that I called a series of pastors to meet for prayer. We have 50 pastors coming to my office tomorrow at 10 o'clock.
That's amazing.
So that next day at 10 o'clock, Ted joined those 50 pastors. They spent an hour on their knees, and they came down to the sanctuary. By this time, they had 500 people.
Oh, wow, that
there.
Is great.
So that's how God orchestrates things.
Raphael, we've covered so much territory here, but I want you to tell us just very briefly now. You remember, we only have 2 minutes, so Ben Franklin saw this carving in the back of George Washington's chair as the sun rising or setting on America. He was happy at that time to conclude that the sun was rising on America. How do you see it?
I see it the same way. I am extremely encouraged. You know, Dean, over the last 2 years, I have done between 65 to 70 pastors' conferences all across America. I've talked perhaps to 10 to 15,000 pastors, encouraging them as to why we need to be involved in the political arena. We need to be salt and light. You know, the Word of God tells us in Proverbs 29:2, when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. When the wicked rule, people mourn. The problem is that the righteous, the people of faith, the people of principle have stayed away from the political process. They are not running for office and not even voting. And what we have allowed is the wicked electing the wicked. Well, I see more and more pastors across America waking up. I think what happened in Houston, was a tremendous catalyst to wake up the church in America, because those battles are occurring all across communities in this country.
That is
so
good.
I am extremely encouraged that we are going to see a dual revival, not only a spiritual revival, but a political revival in parallel, and we will see this country again become that shining city on a hill to the glory of God.
May it be so. Raphael, thank you for sharing with us today. We have another great program next week. Rita, why don't you just give us a teaser about that?
Well, we're going to have one of the attorneys from Alliance Defending Freedom, Christiana Holcomb, talking to us about her work with ADF and how churches can protect themselves from legal challenges.
Fantastic. Well, till next week, this is John Sloop, along with Rita Dunaway and Dean Welty, encouraging you, as Raphael has just said, to be salt and light and to make a difference for Christ at the crossroads where faith and culture meet.